copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I really want to cover a few things. Some I have to cover extremely quickly because I want to get to the heart of the talk, which is, for me, has been extremely thrilling because it's something that I've prepared for the first time, particularly for this talk. But the first part would be a question: does the genome provide evidence for common ancestry? And it very much follows on from the last question that Alex gave to Sigrid. The second part of my talk, which I have to deal with a little bit of detail, is this thought of chromosomal fusion, which we will discuss. And of course, I'm including a word here that sort of betrays the answer, which is the myth of chromosomal fusion. But what I really want to talk about is ancient man. Who exactly were the Neanderthals and the Denisovans, if I'm saying that correctly? I've never heard anybody speak that word, so I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. I'm really not going to talk about this first part because I gave an extended talk on this subject in 2010. Does the genome provide evidence for common ancestry? So I'm assuming that somewhere out in cyberspace, this talk is available. I don't know whether that's true or not. I can't even remember if it was recorded. We looked at a number of things there. The things that I want to highlight here were the things that I really specifically spoke about in that talk, which are not included in what we might call protein-coding genes. These are other elements within the genome. Protein-coding genes only amount to 2, perhaps 3% of the total genome. Everything else is included in these other categories. Now, from an evolutionary point of view, over the years, these elements have been taken as evidence of common ancestry. But of course, my talk, I suppose, when all is said and done, in 2010, was a tale of two books. In a sense, I'm pretty glad that Elizabeth is not here, because she comes from the Faraday Institute, and this was one of the books we spoke about in 2010, and I've got a copy of it, and if anybody wants to take it and read it, then there. The other book was this one, which I was greatly privileged to be involved with, Should Christians Embrace Evolution? One of the things that I find thrilling is that Wayne Grudem made the foreword in that book. The problem with the subject that has been used by even theistic evolutionists to look at that region of the DNA that was originally considered as junk is that before you know where you are, the rug is pulled from beneath your feet. And last year, I was able to speak in greater detail of the genetic findings that have come out of the ENCODE project. And the thing that's so exciting about that is that we now know that at least 80%, remember protein coding genes 2 or 3%, but at least 80% of the genome has function. So all of these other things no longer provide evidence for the theistic evolutionist or even the evolutionist to say that these are evidence of common ancestry. Now, I've highlighted those three regions again on this slide because the fact is this, hold on, I'll go back. The fact is this, we need new definitions. What does it mean, a pseudogene, when it's actually coding for an RNA? Okay? Definitions are a real problem in this area now. Mobile genomic elements, well, they're mobile, that's okay. But retroviral inserts, I believe, is another term that requires a new definition. I'm not going to say any more on that, because I've spoken about it at length, and I've written about it at length. So the question is, so does the genome provide evidence for common ancestry, regardless of what the fossils say? My answer is clearly no, from a genetic perspective. However, I do need to address this second point, and there's a reason for that. Human and great ape chromosomes lined up here. The human is one chromosome. The chimpanzee has two chromosomes. In other words, humans have 23 pairs of chromosomes. Great apes, whether that be the chimpanzee, the orangutan, or the gorilla, they have 24 pairs of chromosomes. The question is, has chromosomal fusion taken place? It's a very significant question. It is assumed that it has taken place because the evolutionary mantra demands it. Now, in my talk, and in my book, not my book, my section in that book, Should Christians Embrace Evolution, I said, possibly, yes. But you see, new findings inevitably pull the rug from under your feet. So I need to address this point. And now it's not a tale of two books. It's a tale of two Jeffreys. Whey, I'm one of them. Now, I want to defend myself. I wasn't dogmatic. I said possibly, yes, okay, possibly, yes. And I wrote about it in that book. What did I use? I'm trying my best to use the best academic material that's available. And that, at the time, seemed persuasive to me, so I wrote about it in that light. However, the information, the academic data, was essentially old, and nearly all of it was before the year 2000. Remember, the human genome was published in 2001. The tale of two Jeffreys, I've got to change it. You know, I'm an English Jeffrey, but the other Jeffrey that I'm going to talk about is an American Jeffrey. And so I'll give him the benefit of the doubt and change the spelling of the name. This is Jeffrey Tompkins. He's written a book, and I've got a copy of it, and if anybody would like to take it, I'm very willing to give it away. Jeffrey Tompkins. Now, in Answers in Genesis, there was this paper published quite recently, alleged, interesting word, human chromosome 2 fusion site, it's a bit technical, encodes an active DNA binding domain inside a complex and highly expressed gene. Jeffrey Tompkins has done a lot of work on this issue with Jerry Bergman, Professor Jerry Bergman, and I commend their work to you. We need to look a little bit at the technicality because this was the rug that was pulled from under my feet. Lack of syntony. Syntony is a technical word. It's where looking at genes in different chromosomes in different species. There is a lack of syntony at the ends of the ape chromosomes. Remember, they're not fused at this point. At the end of the ape chromosomes with the supposed fusion region in the human chromosome. Believe me, I wanted to do this work. It didn't involve any experimentation. It just is data mining on the genome, the published human genome and the published chimpanzee genome. The so-called fusion region is populated, of course this is in the human chromosome, by genes and pseudogenes that are absent from the ape chromosomes. They're just not there in the apes. They're present at this supposed fusion site in the human. And one in particular, which is the, you probably can't read this at the back, an RNA helicase gene, which has a designation, DDXL111. Now, this particular gene is absent in chromosomes 2A on 2B. You understand why they're designated 2A and 2B, because they come together to produce human chromosome 2. This gene is absent in those chromosomes in the chimpanzee or the gorilla. And Tomkins and Bergman quote the work of Costa et al., which was published in an academic journal, Genomics, where using immunofluorescence against this particular gene, they could identify where it was and on what chromosomes it was. The fact is this, there are 18 copies of that gene in the human, but there are only 2 copies in the chimpanzee and only 4 in the gorilla. And if you look at where they are, you see that they're not found in the right places. This is their conclusion. It's technical. I accept that it's technical. Functional, alternatively transcribed, post-transcriptionally spliced, post-transcriptionally regulated, and network-connected expressed genes, such as our gene, an RNA helicase, cannot arise by the head-to-head fusion of chromosomes. It just isn't possible. I think I offended Jerry Bergman once. I tried to have a discussion with him. He wanted to be in touch with me because of what I'd written in that book and what the findings were that they were coming up with. And I pleaded with him, please publish this work in a bona fide, well, can't use that word, in a secular, if you like, academic journal. I pleaded with him to do it. Why do you think they didn't do it or even avoided doing it? I don't know whether they even attempted to do it in Nature even, or one of the prestigious academic scientific journals. I believe with all my heart that it would never be accepted because of the rug that is pulled out from under evolutionary mantra that demands chromosomal fusion to have taken place. When you consider the differences between the human and the chimpanzee chromosomes as a whole, you see that there are vast differences in structure, size, and gene content. Chimpanzees have 10% more DNA than the human, as it happens. I can't talk about these things now. I have talked about them. But the fact is this, these structural changes have profound implications for sexual reproduction. And therefore, I introduce you to come to the workshop and invite you to come there. I think it's tomorrow afternoon. Because for me, sexual reproduction is possibly the greatest challenge to Darwin evolutionism. So that is just a preamble. I could talk very much more about all of those things, but I really want to get on to the heart of the matter. Ancient man, who exactly were the Neanderthals and the Denisovans? I want to talk about the discovery of Neanderthal man, the distribution of Neanderthal man, and the DNA of Neanderthal man. It's a 3D talk. And initially the discovery of Neanderthal man, and I need to take you to a river. It's in a valley. It's the Neander Valley. It's not very far. I don't know whether Alex or Peter come from these places. The Neanderthal, the Neander Valley, which is fairly close to Dusseldorf, and near to that valley there's a cave, the Fieldhofer Grotto. This is where Neanderthal man was discovered. It was discovered in 1856, which is an interesting date. These are some of the finds, the bones, the skull cap, the brow ridge, the very pronounced, really strong character here, the leg bones. Interestingly, 3 years before the publication of The Origin of Species. Now, in that book, Charles Darwin avoided the subject of human evolution, although he did say, light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history. And of course, he was to write a book which he called The Descent of Man, which was published in 1871. Now we move on to 1908, when a much more complete skeleton was discovered in France. Nearly complete skeleton, as you can see from his brain box, that he has a large brain, and of course, like the other finds, a very robust frame, much more so than modern humans. And since then, of course, many, many finds have been found, the distribution of Neanderthal man, and I'm just highlighting four of those places because I will refer to them two more particularly than the other two. We're going to talk more about him and him, but these two are going to be referred to. Also, very briefly, I'm going to show a skull that was discovered in Israel. Of course, they're all found in caves. This is the caveman, right? Why this distribution? It's interesting to me to realize that you can see the extent of the Ice Age in the distribution of ancient man. But now I want to move on to look at what has been found with respect to DNA in the Neanderthal man. Now this paper, this was the first paper that was published actually just before my talk in 2010, and it did briefly refer to it, was the draft sequence of the Neanderthal genome. And Svante Paabo is very much involved, as we saw a picture of him in Sigrid's talk, very much involved in this work. A draft sequence of more than 4 billion nucleotides, and that doesn't mean to say that the Neanderthal man has 4 billion nucleotides. We've got 3.3, I think, billion nucleotides in each of our cells, but they took that DNA from three individuals to come up with the draft sequence. We show that Neanderthals share more genetic variants with present-day humans in Eurasia than with present-day humans in sub-Sahara Africa. They could come to that conclusion. And here we see it again, Neanderthal signatures in Eurasians. Unfortunately, it gets more complicated from this point on, and of course this is exactly what Sigrid was saying in her talk. This was later in the year, again in 2010, the genetic history of an archaic hominin group from the Denisova cave in Siberia. From a finger bone found in the Denisova cave in southern Siberia. Here's the cave. Here's its location in Siberia. This is the excavations and the different levels of excavation. And this is the finger bone, or at least maybe a cast of the finger bone that was used to extract DNA to come up with this genome, just from one individual in this case. This is interesting, just to read, this is within the abstract. The individual is from a group that shares a common origin with Neanderthals, but this population was not involved in the putative gene flow from Neanderthals into Eurasians. However, the data suggests that it contributed 4 to 6% of its genetic material to the genomes of present-day Melanesians. So what can we say? Denisovan signatures in Melanesians. But now it gets much more complicated. This is now 2014 in the journal Nature, the complete genome sequence of a Neanderthal from the Altai Mountains. A proximal toe phalanx. Now, take note, this is a Neanderthal, but the phalanx, the toe phalanx, is found in the east gallery of the Denisova cave, where both the finger and the toe phalanx were found, and is thought to be at least 50,000 years old. I think Andy's question is very pertinent when you come to consider that. Now this is, I think, clutching at straws, that's what I think. The finger was found in sublayer 11.2, whereas the toe derives from a lower or lowest sublayer 11.4, and may thus be older than the finger. I think this is clutching at straws, personally. This is interesting. This is, again, of course, within the paper. Analysis of the relationships and population history of available archaic genomes and 25 present-day human genomes show that several gene flow events occurred among Neanderthals, Denisovans, and early modern humans, possibly including a gene flow into Denisovans from an unknown archaic group. We're talking perhaps three archaic groups, but inevitably is going to get even more complicated. This is later in the year. A mitochondrial genome sequence of a hominin from Cima de los Huesos what does it mean? It means the pit of bones. Again, it's a cave, obviously, a very interesting cave in northern Spain. Let's highlight some more words. Mitochondrial genome sequence of a hominin from Cima de los Huesos, closely related to Denisovans. Let's look at the map. Neanderthals here, as well as Denisovans here, and Denisovans here. It's a very complex picture. Highlight a few more words from this article in Nature in 2014, mitochondrial genome. Question is, what on earth are we talking about here when we consider the mitochondrial genome? This is a little schematic of the human cell, or a cell, animal cell, and here you see these little energy generating factories which are called the mitochondria. Amazingly, they contain circular molecules of DNA. In fact, there are about 100, perhaps sometimes 10,000 of these molecules in every cell. This is so interesting to me as a biochemist. Human mitochondrial DNA codes for 13 proteins that are involved in electron transport chains. And you think, well, that's obvious because the electron transport chain is in the mitochondria after all. However, the mitochondria needs around 1,000 proteins, both in its construction and in the formation of the electron transport chain. So the question for me is, why 13 in the mitochondria? The rest of the mitochondrial DNA codes for essential RNA molecules, so there are other sequences that code actually for RNAs, particular RNAs. This is a very significant point. Mitochondrial DNA is much more easily mutated because it doesn't have the machinery for error correction in the mitochondria. It's in the nucleus. That's an important point, and we need to remember it. So what do we think we know? Just step back a little bit. Perhaps, can't be dogmatic, three distinct groups of ancient man: the Neanderthals, the Denisovans, and a third unknown group. That's where we are today. And clearly, modern man in different parts of the world carries different signatures of these groups. And that leads me on to this paper, which was published in 2014. That's our year, isn't it? Yes, it is. The genomic landscape of Neanderthal ancestry in present-day humans. Genomic studies have shown that Neanderthals interbred with modern humans. This is accepted. And that non-Africans today are the products of this mixture. Of course, this makes the popular press, and this is what The Guardian has to say about these finds. 29th of January 2014. A fifth of Neanderthals' genetic code lives on in modern humans. And this is what he has to say in the article, of course. The last of Neanderthals may have died out tens of thousands of years ago, but large stretches of their genetic code live on in people today. Many of the Neanderthal genes that live on in people today are involved in making keratin, a protein used in skin, hair, and nails. Modern humans may have picked up Neanderthal genes that were better suited to the cold environments, perhaps because they had more or thicker hair or tougher skin. Now, this betrays an ignorance here that we need to try to come to terms with. All right, let's think about this for a minute. Evidence of ancient DNA from two or perhaps three sources is found in the modern human genome. Exactly what does it mean? This signature, we carry signatures of our ancestry. Exactly what does it mean? Are we talking, as indeed The Guardian is inclined to talk, of different genes on different chromosomes? Absolutely not. We are not talking about protein-coding genes. We need, all of us need, the entire component of protein-coding genes. It makes the proteins that is the machinery that we need to be physically alive. What we're talking about here, and it's interesting because there's an enormous confusion out there, we are talking different alleles, which are involved in the variation of the expression of those genes. And with respect, this is what the academic literature says. Neanderthal alleles. That's what they're talking about. They're not talking about different protein coding genes. We identify multiple Neanderthal-derived alleles, that continue to shape human biology. So in other words, different alleles. And I would venture to suggest that are within the non-protein coding regions of our genome will affect the expression of any given gene. And I want to give you a very clear example of this because it's also relevant. We often talk about, have I got genes for blue eyes or genes for brown eyes? I've got a blue gene. My eyes are bluish grey, so have I got a bluey grey gene? Is that true? It's not true at all. Who's got blue eyes? Who's got brown eyes? Adam, that's good. Now, this is all about melanin expression in the iris. Now, this is the melanin production pathway. Tyrosine is the initiating compound. There's an enzyme, a protein enzyme called MelA, tyrosinase, which forms dopaquinone, which then non-enzymatically produces melanin. Melanin is not a protein. It's not a protein. If there is a low expression of MelA in our iris, our eye colour is going to be blue. If we have a high expression of MelA in our iris, we will have brown eyes. It's all about the regulation of gene expression, which is conducted in those non-protein coding regions. So if we have an allele for blue eyes or an allele for brown eyes, it will reside not within the protein coding gene, but outside of it. Of course, the question is, perhaps just one amino acid can be altered in the protein, and here it is just tyrosinase. What happens? Tyrosinase is no longer active. What do we get? We get albinism. These have got, actually, if this was clear, they probably got red eyes under certain light because they got no expression of melanin at all in their iris. This is not a trivial issue, because when we consider the signatures that we carry from the Neanderthal or the Denisovan or maybe from a third archaic group, we're not talking genes, protein coding genes, we're not. We're talking of those regions, non-protein coding regions in our genome, that do show some variation, which leads to changing gene expression of our fixed number of genes. I want to show you another face. This is something really interesting that was published quite recently, again, March 2014, not very long ago. Derived immune and ancestral pigmentation alleles, see the word, in a 7,000-year-old Mesolithic European. This was a real shock. I don't know whether you saw reports of this in the popular media. The Labrana individual carries ancestral alleles in several skin pigmentation genes, suggesting that the light skin of the modern Europeans was not yet ubiquitous in Mesolithic times. This is not such an old individual, but amazingly he expresses a dark skin. Amazingly he expresses a dark skin with blue eyes. Wasn't expected. They thought he was going to be very pale, a pale-skinned European, not that long ago. It was a big shock. And I asked this question.
No.
You don't think so?
No.
Because I know that Sigrid, in her talk, wanted to say this too, and I wanted to say it as well.
Too much hair.
Too much hair. Maybe. That is true. So this is the final part of my talk, and I think I'm doing okay for time. What does the Bible say about ancient man? This is the most important thing to me when all is said and done. For example, is Adam the actual father of humanity? It's important to us as evangelicals. Or is he the federal head of humanity, a Neolithic farmer chosen by God around 10,000 years ago? The reason that I say that is I want to return to this book. I'm glad Elizabeth is not here. This is Dennis Alexander's book, and this is what he writes. God, in his grace, chose a couple of Neolithic farmers in the Near East, or maybe a community of farmers, to whom he chose to reveal himself in a special way. It is for this reason that this first couple or community have been termed Homo Divinus. This term was coined by John Stott. And as an Englishman, the first Christian book I was ever given before I came to faith in Jesus was Basic Christianity by John Stott. So I'm not underestimating how significant that person is, although I think here he was totally misguided. What does Dennis think about the Neanderthals? It has been possible, this is on page 221 of his book, if anybody wants it, you can take it. It's been possible to extract DNA from Neanderthal bone specimens, and an analysis of mitochondrial DNA, I think I've got a spelling mistake, is consistent with the idea that humans and Neanderthals last shared a common ancestor about 500,000 years ago, and that there was no significant interbreeding between the two species. You know, it's very, you need to be very, very thoughtful about putting things into print. I'm very thoughtful about this, and I realized, you know, rug was pulled from under my feet. Absolutely, rugs have been pulled from under Dennis's feet many, many times, and others who want to follow this evolutionary mantra. Something to ponder, and it's a verse in the Bible. This is what it says in the book of Acts. From one, I put into brackets the word man because it's not there in the original Greek. From one, and that's very significant, because the Bible speaks about one. There's one, Adam, even from him came the second. He made every nation of men that should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. This is an interesting diagram. It's from National Geographic, so it's not coming from a creationist source. And you see the migration of ancient man. Melanesians coming this way, and Eurasians here, and so on and so on and so on. And of course, it's really interesting to overlay the extent of the Ice Age onto this diagram. And of course, it fits with the one that I put together. Well, no, the background is available, but I put this extent of Ice Age. You've got movement, maybe, of three different archaic groups. This is a little bit contrived, I admit it. I'm just going to put a little red dot in the middle of this migration pattern, for the simple reason that this is Mount Ararat. And you've got three archaic ancient men. Of course, we've got to bring Babel into this. The descendants of Japheth, the descendants of Shem, the descendants of Ham. Now, obviously, I'm not being dogmatic, because the picture is very confused. It's an approximation. It's encouraging to think that there were three groups of archaic human, actually. I want to just recommend this book maybe you wouldn't look at twice, but it's a really, really well documented book by Bill Cooper. I've got a copy here. This book shows how European history can be traced right back to the flood and the descendants of Japheth through contemporary accounts and the Table of Nations. It's a good book. You might not think so when you look at the book cover, but I recommend it. So the question is the Bible true? Jesus said, "Your word is truth." With great respect to Dennis Alexander, I am convinced he's an evangelical. He must also agree that the Bible is true. But of course, Pilate said to Jesus, "What is truth?" It's easy to interpret in lots of different ways. So I want to change the question. Is the Bible factual? And I want to throw up a verse. Altogether, Adam lived 930 years and then he died. And very quickly, I want to put onto this screen what the early chapters of Genesis speak about when they talk about the ages of men, when they had children and when they died. Very specific, detailed analysis. Very interesting that the flood comes at this time, and the name Methuselah means that when he dies, it will be sent. And Methuselah dies in the year of the flood. Very precise. It's very precise. 2 years after the flood, when Shem was 100 years old, he became the father of Arphaxad. And then, of course, we go right the way down the list. The names are all there. The dates, the years are all there. And very interestingly, after the flood, longevity declined. It took many generations. Even Joseph was 110 years old when he died. Very interesting. Nature 2013. Germline mitochondrial DNA mutations aggravate aging and can impair brain development. Fantastic stuff. We show that low levels of germline transmitted mitochondrial DNA mutations per se can have a lifelong consequences and cause premature aging. And what is more, this is really interesting. I have to go through it quickly. Targeted retrieval analysis of 5 Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA genomes. Just to highlight something, mitochondrial DNA genetic diversity, remember, 5 Neanderthal genomes, was approximately one third of that in contemporary modern humans. What's it saying? It's saying that there wasn't so much mutation in archaic man as there is today. And another paper, 2012, high coverage genome sequence of an archaic Denisovan individual. Genetic diversity in these archaic hominins was extremely low. This is science. This is not a creationist journal speaking. We're talking here of the descent of man, which was Charles Darwin's book published in 1871. In his Origin of the Species, he says light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history. The problem is, as Jesus said, if the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? This is a much better book. I know Andy will also agree.
I have some copies with me.
Thank you, Andy. Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome, John Sanford, recommended. The Flood, but the person that I want to highlight here is Abraham, who was 175 years old when he died. Adam lived 175 years, his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave. At the moment I can pass by Hebron. Through the occupied territories, and I can visit where Abraham was buried, although if we actually found his bones it might look a little bit like this. Ancient man, more robust, bigger brain, characteristic brow ridges. But another fantastic truth is that craniofacial bones and tissues alter with longevity. This is an old paper, the dichotomous pattern of craniofacial expansion during aging. The cranial facial skeleton expands during adult life. The dual enlargement, it's dichotomous. It's what it means is the front of the face changes far more than the back of the head. More recent paper, aging in the mid-face, bony elements, a three-dimensional computed tomographic study. This is what they say. These results suggest that the bony elements of the midface change dramatically with age, and coupled with soft tissue changes lead to the appearance of the aged face. I'm going to use an example. Who's this person? Any ideas?
Charles Darwin.
It is Charles Darwin. This is not a photograph, of course. This was him painted as a seven-year-old in the 1816. Fantastic example of this. This is him as a young man. This is him as an older man, 45 years old. I don't think I look quite as old as this when I was 45. This is Charles Darwin as an old man. You see his brow ridge. This is a skull that was found in Israel with its brow ridge. Of course, Charles Darwin is an interesting example because he was only in his 70s when he died. But just think, 175 years old. See the difference between him as a young man and an old man. This is one of the Neanderthal children that have been discovered, and I showed you in my initial slide where this was found. He doesn't have a brow ridge. This is his skeleton. He's just a child. He might be 2 years old. This is an even younger Mesmaeskaya neonate, newly born. This is the recreation of his skull. No brow ridge. I want to introduce the work of somebody who I regard as a friend now, Jack Quozzo, because he had unparalleled access to Neanderthal skulls. And here you see in his book some of the X-ray analyses that he did on the size and the shape. Really, really commend this book. I wish he'd written it a little bit differently, because it's very, very detailed. There's a lot of technical detail in this book, but he begins the book as if he is Indiana Jones. And I don't think that goes down quite so well in a serious audience, but I have the highest regard for this man's work. He was a professional orthodontist, very significant. He and his son, who is a professor, have developed an algorithm for skull changes over time. And the other very interesting thing that Jack has shown in his work, he's not speculating, he's shown it because of unerupted teeth. He's an orthodontist, has demonstrated slow maturation in the adult Neanderthal. And this is really interesting because academic literature also supports that idea of a slower paced development, albeit large, late maturing mothers, than in modern Homo sapiens. Maturation was much, much slower. Here you see the reason why this larger skull, even in a neonate Neanderthal, requires a much more substantial pelvis. On the other hand, and Jack brings some of these thoughts out in his book, although he wrote the book several years ago. This is 2012, the International Journal of Epidemiology. The decreasing age of puberty, as much a psychosocial as biological problem, it's asking a question. This is a fact, just as we are thinking of genetic deterioration. The mean age of puberty in girls in Western populations has been falling for the last 150 years. What's happened is our maturation is getting faster and faster and faster. And so, in summary, how am I going for time? I think I'm okay. I'm being modest. The genome provides little evidence for common descent. Whatever those skulls are, whatever those creatures are that Sigrid has so beautifully told us about, when you get down to the genetics, there's nothing to support common ancestry. Nothing. And now I can say this. Chromosomal fusion, which is part of the evolutionary mantra, is an absolute myth. The fact is we carry allelic signatures from ancient man, certainly Neanderthal, Denisovan, and perhaps another. And we generally accept this in the scientific community. Ancient man coexisted, cohabited, and interbred with Homo sapiens because ancient man was fully human. The skeletal characteristics of ancient man is indicative of great age and slow maturation. This is supported by the fact that mitochondrial DNA is more easily mutated, resulting in premature aging. In my opinion, the Bible is accurate and compatible with scientific discovery. So, what makes us fully human? And at this point, I want to go back to the valley, the Neander Valley, the Neanderthal. If any man is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has gone, the new has come. This was the experience of this new man. His name was Joachim Neumann, Germanic new man. He only was 30 when he died. It's amazing to me. It was the thing that they did in those days was to change his name to Neander, which I think is Greek for new man. Joachim Neander. He walked around that valley, and it was named after him, the Neanderthal. And he wrote many hymns, possibly in this valley. And this one is perhaps his most famous. And it's the beautiful version that I want to play and praise the Lord. It's sung by an American called Christy Knuckles.
taking us through this genetic journey and into worshiping our Creator. We have a few minutes for a few questions. John, you've raised your hand very quickly.
Some years ago, yeah, I came across an article called Noah's Blood, and it was an analysis of the way in which blood was distributed. And the question on the head of the thing was there a bottleneck? And I've since tried to trace that. Does that evidence still exist?
I don't know of that article, John. I should repeat the question. This is to do with Noah's blood, an article written on Noah's blood, which seemed to indicate that there was a bottleneck. And I don't know of that article, but it doesn't really surprise me because I do believe that there was a bottleneck. And from out of that, out of the ark has flowed humanity as we know it today. If that article was supportive of that idea, then that's wonderful. We're not making an issue of time, but I think Andy's point that he raised in Sigrid's talk is a very relevant one, because here we're talking of DNA analysis in Neanderthals that are considered to be, we're not talking millions of years, but of course we've got dinosaur analysis as well now, but we're talking relatively tens of thousands of years. Well, it's an incredibly interesting subject. I don't think you could be dogmatic as to whether they're anti or post-diluvian. Certainly the general consensus in those that actually think that this is reasonable work is that they're post-diluvian. And of course, when you looked at that chart, you see that longevity continued for very many generations post-flood. Of course, it rapidly declined, but as I used as an example, Abraham, he was 175 years. If Darwin was 75, just think of the craniofacial changes of Abraham if he was 175 when he died. Can I just add one other thing? Because it was a revelation. I'd like to think it was a revelation, and it will be my contribution to paleoanthropology. If this is true in man, it has to be true in the apes. And if we're talking longevity in man, we have to include as the missing link in our understanding of fossils also longevity and craniofacial changes that take place in skulls over time. I need to repeat. Well, it wasn't really a question. It was a statement that Andy McIntosh made. The basic gist of Andy's point was mitochondrial DNA mutation is measurable, and it is interesting that in archaic humans, the diversity which is related to that is much less than in modern humans. And of course, it does have an impact on the signatures that we retain in our DNA, but that's another point. But I think the point that Andy makes is this enhances, this exacerbates the problem of genetic meltdown, and therefore means that ages need to be rethought. Mutation rate is very interesting because it also has another knock-on effect when we're considering the branching of our supposed evolutionary tree.
Richard?
The radiocarbon data is valid for this whole period.
Well, again, that's a statement. But it's talking about the significance of carbon-14 in an analysis of even Neanderthal man is would be very significant to do. I don't know whether much has been done. I'm not sure.
Sorry.
This is a good point, and I do realise absolutely that Jack is not the bee's knees when it comes to all creationists. And Martin Lubanoff, in his book Bones of Contention, wants to portray the Neanderthal as a pathological specimen of maybe rickets or syphilitic changes in skulls. If you go on YouTube, you can see some of Jack's lectures where he completely deflates that argument. But of course, maybe he is selective. The book Buried Alive was published really quite a long time ago, and of course more skeletons have been found. Having said that, the ones that are published certainly that I've seen, and I would value any input on that, show the child being doesn't show that brow ridge. The other thing that comes with Jack's work, because he's an orthodontist, is looking at maturation on the basis of teeth eruption, largely. This is his speciality. This has been his career. And in fact, from that, you can show a very different maturation rate in the Neanderthal than the one that we experience today. The other interesting thing, and it's another contribution that I would wish to make to paleoanthropology, and I'm not a paleoanthropologist, is the whole idea of teeth. Because it's quite interesting that in some of the early skulls, why they are considered ancestral to humans is because they don't show very pronounced canine teeth. They're much more human-like, like ours. They haven't got the really large canine teeth. And I see that as an aspect of nature being red in tooth and claw. I mean, it's interesting that it says that.
Where can you imagine to stack some missing genealogies to extend the age of
Well, this is a very pertinent question. I want to avoid answering it completely, but chronologies, I think, are not necessarily complete. But you cannot extend the timescale that much. The other thing that I feel strongly about is that the fall of man starts the clock. Prior to the fall of man, time doesn't have any meaning. So that's another issue where there might be flexibility. The other thing that I personally believe in is that I do believe that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And then God said, "Let there be light." There's room for movement there too. Now, I know I've got dear friends here that will come and hammer me for saying that, and you might be one of them, Stashek, but that's okay. But that makes me feel that the time element is perhaps not quite such a critical element. That's what I think. Having said that, those precise ages of ancient man, they're either the truth or they're, what are they? They're nothing. Very detailed, very specific, factually correct, in my opinion.
Thank you very much for your leadership.